I've been building up to the review in a step-by-step fashion for 40 years. In fact, it goes back even to my PhD dissertation in 1968, because my dissertation was on the idea of optimum population.
Welcome to this podcast produced by the International Monetary Fund. In today's program, the author of the Dasgupta Review on Biodiversity Economics.
So in a way, this kind of limitations to the human enterprise, if you like, has been at the back of my mind, but it was never quite as explicit as it is in the review. I'm Partha Dasgupta. I'm Professor Emeritus of Economics at the University of Cambridge and Fellow of St. John's College at Cambridge.
Nature is often missing in economic models, but in his study commissioned by the UK government, Partha Dasgupta looks at the economic benefits of biodiversity and the costs of losing it, and sets out a framework for including nature in our economic thinking. Professor Dasgupta published an article about his findings in the September edition of Finance and Development. And in this conversation, he talks about how much of his work since the beginning of his career has led up to this 600-page review on the economics of biodiversity.
I think there are about six books that I wrote over the period of from 1979 to up to the review, each of which is actually a stepping stone to the review. But of course, I'm saying that now retrospectively. But at the time I was doing those books, I didn't have the review in mind.
So you were, it was like you were destined to write this review.
If you want to put it that way, yes, I think so. I was really pleased to be asked, and I had no doubt about it. The only thing I did was to ask my wife, who always advises me, would take a step without it. We've been married for 53 years, so we were kids when we got married. So, and she said, of course you must do it.
So the study clearly shows that nature's assets are in a free fall, really. Extinction rates alone in the past 40 years are such that animal species have decreased by almost 70%. Where does economics fit into this discouraging story?
Economics fits into it very snugly because it's not economics that is at fault. It's we practitioners of economics who are at fault. Particularly academic economists, because it's easy to blame governments, but the government civil servants were once upon a time our students. And they carry with them a intellectual infrastructure, which we academics, that is, imparted to them. And there's a backwards and forwards kind of relationship, because the more they use macroeconomic reasoning, which does not have the biosphere in mind, it's purely capital accumulation of the old-fashioned sense of human capital and produced capital. The more they use it, the more we academics are encouraged to elaborate on them, improve upon them, and so forth. But the improvement takes place in a lower dimension, if you like, of capital stocks, on the space of capital stocks. It continues to be without natural capital. And the review tries to correct that. And I was very, very keen to create a parallel set of models which will capture, if you like, the intuitive sense that we humans are embedded in nature. We are not external to it. We can't build models in which nature doesn't appear and then simply graft onto it a bit of nature when it's convenient for us to do so. So, for example, climate change models, on the whole, are conventional models of growth and development, onto which you plug in a climate sector. And the climate sector's typical modeling procedure would be that output has a byproduct, let's call it carbon, that's emitted into the atmosphere. And the rate at which that can be neutralized by the biosphere, if that falls short of the rate at which you're emitting it, then the carbon concentration increases. So you've got a dynamic equation for carbon concentration. And that concentration affects either output or utility, depending on your mood, adversely. So you have a closed loop there and you optimize it. And the advantage of studying such models as in climate change is that you can start thinking about alternative technologies. So then you can add to it another sector, called R&D sector, let us say, which will reduce the ratio of emission to output. And if you can reduce it sufficiently, why then you're laughing because you're investing your way out of trouble. So the idea that the climate system is independent of the rest is misleading. And therefore, a whole lot of implications arise from these facts and the embeddedness of the human enterprise in nature. It seems slightly metaphysical kind of statement, but it has deep mathematical structure to it. You can't escape the biosphere through ingenuity. That's a very precise statement.
So you said at the very beginning of that answer that economics is not at fault. How is it that the basic, one of the basic principles anyway of economics is supply and demand? How is it that has not worked when it comes to our natural assets? You know, why has demand outstripped the supply for so long without consumers feeling, or at least barely feeling, any consequences at all?
That's a very good question. And it does require a deeper answer than a slick sentence or two. It, of course, at the background is the idea of externalities, which is not new. We economists have discussed it for over 100 years now. By externalities, I mean an unaccounted consequences to others of our own actions. Okay. And I think there is a sense in which we economists did not appreciate until very recently that externalities are not the exception, they're the rule. And that fact, the fact that they're the rule at the global level, is something that has emerged really over the past 70 years. There is an explanation, and that is that the human enterprise has exploded in its power in the last 70 years. That's one of the opening chapters of my review shows that, for example, GDP, global GDP has increased by a factor of 15 or so over a 70-year period from 1950 to 2020, let us say, from a really rather high base, historically speaking. 1950, the world as a whole was a lot richer than it has been traditionally. And after that, you have a 15-fold increase. So you've got an incredible expansion of the human enterprise. And so the question is, why would the externalities explode through that? And that has to do with certain properties of the biosphere, one of which is obvious, and everybody knows that, which is that nature is mobile. So that what you do in Washington in due course has a consequence in the Antarctic or whatever. That's one kind of externality. And I think in some sense we can be excused, or the profession can be excused, for not recognizing, even as things were improving over this 70-year period, that alongside that improvement in the quality of life, that entire growth process was at the expense of our resource base, the capital asset. We were actually depreciating. So I think the models didn't pick that up at all. But there are two further reasons, properties of nature, which I'm increasingly coming to believe have hampered our understanding. And when I say our understanding, I don't really mean just the economists, I mean the citizens, any citizen. And they are that nature's processes in large measure are both silent and invisible. The processes, what's inside the tree, what's under our feet, what's happening in the soil, all that stuff, all these processes going on, producing stuff that we take for granted, and that's all silent and invisible. And if it's invisible and silent, you have a problem of monitoring. When I say problem, I mean serious problem. It can't be done. So it's easy to overlook these processes. A factory chucks out, making a lot of noise, shuts down, you don't hear it, and you say, yes, there's something problematic here. Production is halting. But you can't quite make that parallel statement over in nature's process when you don't even know that it's happening? So I think that's how I would put it, that the externalities were expanding at a furious rate parallel with our growing economies. We only saw the surface advantages of the growth. And of course, when I say surface, I don't want to belittle the fact that people have had it's a great achievement of the last 70 years. But the other flip side of it is that we have really done it at the expense of our grandchildren and all those that are to follow. And we now have to come to grips with that.
Yes, that indeed is very unfortunate. You suggest in this article that you've written for Finance and Development, you suggest the only way really to address this over demand of our resources is to make people pay for what they use. But you also suggest this, which I thought was very interesting, is a type of reparations, really, where nations affected by climate shocks should be paid for their perceived loss of output. What would implementing something like that entail? I mean, is it even feasible politically, do you think?
Well, the feasibility politically is something that I have no expertise on, so I'll stick to my expertise, which
okay.
is as an analytical. The harm we are doing to each other and thus to ourselves is reflected in many ways. So one of the points I think I made in that article, if I haven't made it, I should have, but I've certainly made it elsewhere, and certainly it's in the review, is that because of these externalities, these missing markets, if you like, that's one way of putting it, a great deal of the exports of primary products from poor countries to rich countries, and this is something of importance and interest, should be of interest to the IMF, are sold at prices which do not reflect the social cost of the exports from the poor country's point of view. So if there's deforestation in the uplands of a rainforest, let us say, then the damage that is inflicted downstream, quite apart from biodiversity loss, never mind that, is not captured in the export price because there's nobody to pay, to compensate the losers. So the export price being lower than the social cost as perceived by the nation, exporting nation itself, or should be perceived by the exporting nation itself, is one way of saying that there's a wealth transfer from the poor country, exporting country, to the importing country. And that's of course completely perverse, because it's the poor who are supporting the rich for the imports of their goods. Mm-hmm. Now, when I say it's perverse, this is not a conspiratorial theory, by the way. I'm not suggesting there's anybody who's actually being rapacious. It's one of those things, it's a missing market. Nobody takes these things into account. You're looking at only GDP or export revenue. And the fact that you're actually eroding your domestic capital base is not being reflected in the national statistics. So nobody knows, except, of course, the poor feel it, because their productivity of their own property is declining and they don't know why. So in a world like that, so that's just one example. In a world like that, to claim that trade expansion benefits the poor countries is just wrong.
Yeah.
The good economic theory tells us that free trade is certainly efficient if and only if all goods have a market, competitive market at that. So that's one class of problems. Another class is, of course, another aspect of the question that you raised, is that it's not a happenstance that the richest, most biodiverse regions are in the tropics. And the tropics also house the world's poorer countries. Poorest countries, and some not so poor maybe, but it also means that these countries are the home of some enormously important global public goods, because these forests house such huge biodiversity, and then the services that we get, for example, carbon sequestration. So that's a public good, but it's not an open access resource. It's national jurisdiction. And so in a world like that, we should be thinking in terms of a payment for ecosystem services at the international level. We have the idea of payments for ecosystem services within nations. China, the UK, Costa Rica are moving in that direction. Farmers are paid for services that their land provides, neighboring ecosystems, and so forth. So that's That would be a suggestion that comes immediately out of the economic theory that we need to compensate them for preserving the global public goods, because they could say, as they are indeed saying, that, look, who are you to tell us not to remove the size of Portugal from Amazon every 2 years or so, because we need to grow and we're going to have cattle ranches there or soybean plantations. Who are you to tell us that we shan't do that? And they have some justification. I mean, please put it this way. If they say it, what are you going to do about it? It's no good just simply sitting out there and beating our heads and saying how awful that it is. We ought to do something about it. And that the proposal is that we should compensate. We should come to an arrangement where we pay for those services. But where does this money come from? That's part of your question. I don't know whether it's politically feasible, but there is a source. And the review goes into that at great length, which is that we have these open access resources, like the open oceans, beyond the 200-mile EEZ. And that's a lot of property. Nobody owns it. They're open access. And so the oceans are being tarnished because we don't pay any rents for their use. Just imagine the amount of traffic on the oceans, of all the oil that is being transported from one place to another, all the goods and services, these container ships, they're not paying for the privilege of shipping the stuff. And so if you have a global commons like that, and then of course there's the atmosphere, and I don't need to talk about the atmosphere as a residue for our pollution, because that too is a global public good, the atmosphere, which is a sink for our solutions, and we're not paying for that either. But let's stick to the oceans for the moment. Now, very crude calculations suggest that we can raise huge amounts of money if we charge, which would have happened if the oceans were actually private property. Now, in order to do that, of course, you need an international organization like the IMF or the World Bank. I'm not saying the IMF and World Bank per se, but I said like them. The World Bank and the IMF are supplying public goods. That's why we have them. Financial stability of nations, for example, in one case, development, poverty alleviation, another case. So it seems to me the natural thing to do is for us to think about an international institution, organization, which would be awarded the mandate to monitor, manage, charge for the use of the global commons. But that's not on the agenda. But if you raise that kind of money, you could easily support the subsidies that you need to pay for the protection of the global public goods, which are in the national jurisdictions.
And lastly, do you believe that the upcoming COP15 and COP26 meetings in the fall might provide some opportunities to start talking about, these transformations that you suggest need to happen if we're going to deal with climate change?
Well, I hope so. This is the Economics of Biodiversity, the Gupta review that I was referring to. It's 600 pages long, and it's not a political document. It's a it's an economics document. So what I've said is we have had it very, very good, but at the expense of the future. And our young may be alive to see some of the prices that we have to pay for this. And that's happened simply because we have neglected aspects of our economy, a serious aspect of the economy, the foundations of our economy. But I'm not a psychologist. I do not know why it's taking time. And I'm hoping very much that 26 and 15 COPs will address some of these problems, largely because I think they're analytically so easy to understand. And given the significance of it, of the errors that we are making, how large quantitatively these errors are, and that's one of the things that the review does, I think, I like to think well, we can't simply hide behind the argument that, look, this is not politically feasible. That's just rubbish. What is politically feasible is something that you feel very strongly about, and these are collective problems we are facing. It's not one against the other. These are global public goods which are being destroyed. We have to do it because good economics, good reasoning tells us that it's necessary. So I hope something like this happens in these two COPs.
Partha Dasgupta, Professor Emeritus of Economics at the University of Cambridge. Thanks so much for speaking with us today about your economic review of biodiversity. And let's hope it does, in fact, make some waves at those COP15 and COP26 meetings.
Well, thank you very much. It was a pleasure to meet you, Bruce. And let's hope for the best.
You can read Partha Dasgupta's article titled Economics Nature's Way in the September edition of Finance and Development magazine. Check it out at imf.org/FND or download the Finance and Development app. And look for other IMF podcasts wherever you get your podcasts. You can also follow us on Twitter at imf_podcast. I'm Bruce Edwards. Thanks for listening.